Hello, welcome again to Sports Unlocked, going through all the week's sports news with me, Rob Harris from Sky News, Martin Ziegler from The Times, and Tarek Panja from The New York Times. This week, together at the Football Blacklist Awards, a great initiative in England.
A great evening. So these awards, they recognise the first black lioness, who was Kerry Davis, played for England in 1982. She was actually one of the few English players at that time who actually played semi-professionally, because she went to Italy to play for Lazio.
So, yeah, certainly a pioneer across football. Other players are also honoured. Trent Alexander-Arnold, partly for his initiative to help to provide pathways for players leaving academies, as well as Nikita Paris and Jess Carter. Many from the media as well, and across coaching and behind the scenes. And, you know, really something started about 15 years ago now by Leon Mann, who was a journalist, now involved in many things across the sport. Rodney Hines from the Voice newspaper.
Amazing endeavour from Leon all these years on.
And this coming in a week when, you know, we were reminded yet again of the racist abuse that players are facing. There was this case in Serie A at the weekend, Napoli's Juan Jesus, who was allegedly racially abused by the Inter Milan defender Francesco Acerbi. Then he was removed from Italy's squad ahead of the upcoming games.
And also Vinicius Junior again. Real Madrid had to file a complaint against the referee of their last match because he didn't include racism that was directed at Vinicius Junior's game, and that's gone to the Spanish FA. He seems to be almost like a weekly target of this over there in Spain.
Yes, and it's how much impetus there is within Spain to tackle it, how tough they actually get in terms of, you know, the action and the messaging. And this all building up to the FIFA Congress in Bangkok in May, where Gianni Infantino is saying there will be some big resolution attempts to tackle racism. And then at England's training session this week at St George's Park, ahead of friendlies, there was a seemingly innocuous picture posted by the journalist Henry Winter from England training that sparked an absolutely torrent of racist abuse. And in the picture, four great English talents.
Carl Walker, Jude Bellingham, Marcus Rashford, Ivan Toney, a sort of stream of horrible racist replies. People who I think have sort of been empowered maybe by this sort of takeover of Twitter or X by Elon Musk and this sort of thing about free speech and that they can say what they want, and despite the fact it's actually probably a criminal offence in many ways. It's just sickening.
Yeah, they've got rid of, in terms of some of the monitoring and the capabilities of tackling this stuff, Twitter or X is clearly not what it was previous to the Musk takeover. But also it speaks to this wider issue, doesn't it? That these platforms and are a place for these cave dwellers to come together and feel empowered to say this nonsense. And I recommend people to read under that. And Henry's tweet was basically simply celebrating what great talent England has at the moment. And he's right. You know, this England squad is fantastic, and it should be a unifying force, not used for that nonsense.
Yeah, and one of the reasons, as we record, it probably has 15 million views is there are a lot of people calling out that racist abuse as well now, and being absolutely gasped at some of the language used.
Do you wonder if some of this is like a game now? Like, who can I get onto Twitter? Can I get my abhorrent comment commented on? And then you're in this kind of gamification of racism online, because it's just quite easy to do, isn't it? It's anonymous. You fire this stuff out and you might feel a bit of a rush because, like, oh, look, I've got all these people angry.
Yeah, because this isn't just anonymous accounts. Some of these are people with a lot of followers who it's a sort of political message, which is, to me, that is like more worrying in a way than, you know, just the sort of random racists sort of shouting out abuse. It seemed to me like a sort of political, and I thought that was really, you know, people talking about ethnic English, I mean, which is just ridiculous because, you know, whatever the colour of the people's skins in that England squad, they're all going to come from a huge variety of backgrounds, and it's just, you know, it makes you worry about that social media platform, the way it's going.
And we can't even talk to anyone at Twitter X these days. Obviously, they got rid of a load of staff. Elon Musk did, so don't even know who there is in comms you can speak to. Something also troubling out of France, where it's being reported by outlets including ESPN, that the under-19s midfielder Mamadou Diawara has left the international camp because the French Federation is banning players from fasting during Ramadan when training.
Yeah, I saw that report, Rob. And again, France has always stood out. You know, we had this issue of France as a secular state, laïcité, and all of that in France. And we've seen it with headscarf bans for Muslim women. And now during Ramadan, it seems there's been a diktat from the French Football Federation that has told all players of all age group teams, including the seniors, that if you are with the senior, with the French national team, you cannot be fasting. And this is, again, is to do with this idea that religion is private and the French national team and these national symbols must not be used in that way. But it just seems so over the top and completely unfair on players. Whereas you look around Europe, rest of Europe, and a lot of strides are being made to make Muslim players feel accommodated, particularly during Ramadan.
Yeah, breaks in matches in England in particular, and certainly something talked about around the clubs, a load of iftar events being held around English football too.
Yeah. And, you know, again, this makes France stand out again, and perhaps not in a good way. players have talked about issues in the past, but now clubs and players have worked together, nutritionists. There's a growing number of Muslim players across the top European leagues, and that is a part of modern football.
Certainly, again, putting emphasis on this big initiative by Gianni Infantino ahead of the FIFA Congress. And ahead of that Congress, they've sent out the annual report to all the FAs to study the finances of FIFA. Big revenue projections certainly feature in there, very ambitious ones. In terms of the target, they think they're going to get $11 billion in the 2023-2026 cycle. Well, that's up from about $7 billion, isn't it? And a pay rise for Gianni Infantino, base salary growing 33%. Last year, he banked $4.6 million plus.
I wouldn't say no to that.
The Confederation presidents aren't doing that badly either. I think Alexander Sheffrin's on around 3 million euros. Victor Montagliani at CONCACAF, $2.5 million. And I'm sure the others aren't too far behind. But guys, those numbers, they pale in significance to some of the other big sporting leaders, don't they? People who run leagues and in football and elsewhere. That's what these guys always say. Don't just scream the headline numbers. But they're also politicians, aren't they? They're elected officials. They're not chief executives in the way others are. And these salaries do seem quite high in that sense when you look at someone who's like elected for a role.
Yeah, that's the thing about this. Like, what is a fair salary as FIFA president? What is the right salary? So his base salary was 1.95 million Swiss francs with a bonus of 1.65 million. That was in 2022. That has gone up to 2.6 million Swiss francs. That's about the same in dollars in terms of the base salary, and he's got the same bonus of 1.65 million Swiss francs. We can get onto who approved that in a moment, but as an example, what Joe Biden earns, around $400,000, the UK Prime Minister well below sort of £200,000. Are these positions that you do for the sort of prestige, the honour, and you can earn money in later life? Are they different from, say, an NFL commissioner, because that is a private entity, whereas FIFA makes a big play of being not-for-profit? Or, given the fact that Gianni Infantino has overseen such a big rise in revenue, they're predicting from, what, $7.5 billion to $11-plus billion, well, a large salary increase might reflect that.
Yes, but it depends what his job is. And again, this is the issue. Gianni Infantino, ever since he's walked into FIFA's doors, has not been the president the FIFA statutes that he helped draw up have recommended him to be, this kind of less hands-on, figure. He's supposed to be the guiding figure of the organization. Meanwhile, other people get on with the business. So what are the targets? What are the parameters of this bonus or any of these bonuses? What has he actually contributed? How is that measured? And you're going to tell us, Rob, who decides this bonus?
Well, in terms of the bonus, both years, 2022, 2023, delivered the men's and women's FIFA World Cups seemingly smoothly, delivered to completion. Well, I wonder if that's part of the bonus. If they didn't go ahead, they were full of chaos of some sort.
So a bonus for not screwing up, you're saying?
We don't know. That's the thing, isn't it? Not a bad year. So who decides the pay? Well, it's the compensation subcommittee, which features three people, and that is Mukal Modal, a retired Indian judge, someone from the Swiss accountancy world, Bruno Chiamento, and then one Alejandro Dominguez, who is a vice president of FIFA as the president of CONMEBOL, the South American Confederation. It was pointed out to me, yes, well, this is a separate committee, but we know that these are people at World Cup matches. At least we know Dominguez is there, and we've spotted Mukdal going to FIFA events. So he's mixing with the same people they're sort of deciding this on. They're not completely all separate and independent. What?
No, and then Mukdal is one that you know I have particular interest in, having seen him operate at close hand. I'm sure you know he has a great history as a judge in India. Just from close quarters, though, I remember this incident at the Russia World Cup just before the start of it in Moscow at the luxurious Lotte Hotel, where he was billeted alongside FIFA luminaries, including the president and the council, which was odd in itself. But I saw him just making sure and really making sure, stressing to the staff that he was due to be in a suite, not a normal room. Now, if you are enjoying that kind of largesse, that kind of grace and favor treatment, when it comes to working out a bonus, you might be thinking about that. Well, you know, it beggars belief, doesn't it?
I was there with you when we encountered that moment in the lobby of the FIFA hotel. No chance to get a comment from him on that.
No.
The bonuses are, we should probably point out that they are considerably less than Sepp Blatter and Jerome Valcke received. Valcke, for example, I think he received 30 bonuses worth 30 million Swiss francs, 9 million for the 2010 World Cup, 10 million for the 2013 Confederations Cup and the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, and then 11 million ahead of the Confederations Cup and 2018 World Cup in Russia. So they're considerably below that. And I think people would like to sort of point to the NFL commissioner to justify their high pay, because I think he earned something like $64 million in 1 year in 2021. So it's obviously not in that ballpark, but still a very large amount of money.
Yeah, you mentioned Jerome Valcke there. He's the former, of course, Secretary General. Top order amongst the crises and scandals of the end of the Blatter era. And yes, Blatter himself, for the 2014 World Cup year, had a bonus of $12 million on top of a salary of $3 million. So Gianni Infantino's salary absolutely dwarfed by some of those deals that Sepp Blatter was managing to secure internally. But obviously, Infantino now can potentially stay in power till 2031 based on the last request to the council. And I was actually corrected by FIFA. They told me this is not Gianni Infantino's third term, it's his second term, so they really aren't counting that first term. It didn't exist 2016 to 2019 because it was completing Sepp Blatter's complete term. But you know, that it's not only a matter of semantics, it's a way of do the 12-year term limits really apply to him? And you certainly got to think he's well positioned to earn a lot of money afterwards, given some of the relations around the world.
Plenty more time to earn a lot more money. And to Martin, you know, you mentioned Valcke. Let's just confirm that he now is a convicted felon, and Blatter is remains under investigation. So maybe not the two people you want to compare yourselves to if they are trying to justify it that way.
Something we often used to focus on in those FIFA accounts with the size of the cash reserves, and they do sort of sit around sort of $3-4 billion these days, which are protection there in case there are issues with events and the unforeseen. Something that came out as the FIFA meeting last week, we mentioned on last week's pod, was the fact that they decided to award these under-17s World Cups to Qatar and Morocco, five consecutive editions of them, 48-team World Cups, and no real sense of the process about how they were awarded. But we have heard from one nation that did want to hold the men's version.
Yeah, the Danish FA said that they had expressed an interest in hosting them. Didn't have any communication about it in response from FIFA, and then were surprised to find that they'd been awarded to Qatar for the next 5 years. The FIFA say that it was a proper process. This was a recommendation by the administration, which went to the FIFA Council, and that I think they said that in last November, all the national associations were written to and see if they wanted to express interest in hosting them. But it does seem to be certainly the Danish FA were very surprised by how it all turned out.
In a it's a smaller scale, but doesn't it remind you of how the FA's found out about the 2030 and 2034 World Cups? I remember Australia in particular were surprised, and we talked to Lisa Klaveness of Norway, and so how did you find out where the World Cups are going? And it was in the press release that was sent to the media. And again, I think this is again the same issue. This was just announced, and everyone has to get on with it. And the same situation of having no ability to question the decision makers after these big meetings, because again, not to harp on about it, but we still haven't had a press conference.
Do you know something? It did strike that lack of press conference. I know from within FIFA that they were anticipating who would spot the line about Gianni Infantino's salary first. This is afterwards, and so they, comms wise, they're expecting it to be a line. So it got me thinking how ideal it would have been for Gianni Infantino for that line to come out there, but him to do a press conference on the same day, but float something that was an even bigger headline, like some new plan or new initiative or something that would dominate the headlines. Instead, the only Infantino Google hits largely now for the last week all relate to Gianni Infantino's salary.
Rob, it sounds like that's a come and get me plea.
To make clear, that's not. Something I can say after the event, and of course we would still have reported the other, but it just shows perhaps the lack of thought through process in Gianni Infantino not doing media means that the headlines that will dominate will be the ones fully that we discover. On more serious matters that have affected FIFA over recent months, the ongoing fallout from Luis Rubiales and that non-consensual kiss on Jenni Hermoso, now subject to criminal investigations.
Yeah, he had his house raided as part of an operation by Spanish police investigating this controversial deal to give the Spanish Super Cup to Saudi Arabia, which this was organised with a company owned by the former Barcelona player Gerard Piqué. Rubiales was out of the country at the time, but there have been several arrests. He's not been arrested yet. He is under investigation.
But there's also some really kind of tawdry events here being investigated, hiring detectives to spy on the head of Spain's players' union, misusing the funds to pay for personal expenses, even allegedly hosting a sex party with federation funds. I don't know if this guy could look any worse after what happened in Sydney and the fallout, his refusal to resign following that kiss, and all the drama that ensued. But God, in terms of reputation, this guy was, don't forget, not only the head of Spanish football, but a vice president at UEFA. When he left, he was even thanked for his services. Just before he was given that ban from FIFA. What a fall from grace.
Yeah, and this is a separate strand of investigations, unconnected to the Hermoso case, and shining quite a spotlight on you know, just why a country like Spain is taking one of its main competition events to another country. It, you know, obviously in this case, Saudi Arabia, which was raising all sorts of questions at the time, La Liga were opposing it, weren't they? Until they, now they themselves have their own deals with Saudi Arabia.
That's right. They were. And look, at the moment, we don't know if he's going to be implicated in this in a direct way. But there's also a huge, huge glare now on Gerard Piquet. And this was an incredible deal because don't forget, he was an active player. I think he might have been captain of Barcelona at the time this was done. It was his company, Cosmos, with a K, that brokered the deal, earning a spectacular commission. It's said to be 10% of the total per tournament. So they were essentially 24 million euros over 6 years for Gerard Piqué while he was still playing. He even played in the first two editions of this. So you know, there's going to be a lot more to come.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. And interesting, there were some leaked messages that came out between Rubiales and Piqué where he was basically, as part of the deal, they would, but if Barcelona or Real Madrid got to the Super Cup final, they'd receive more money than any other team, like four times as much. It's amazing that these sorts of things happen, isn't it? But, you know, when there's huge amounts of money going around and to be made, people will cut corners and do secret deals and behave inappropriately, absolutely.
Obviously, those involved denying wrongdoing across the case, reportedly worth 40 million euros per tournament for the Spanish FA, this transformation of the Spanish Super Cup into a four-team mini tournament. So much our focus, obviously, on Saudi Arabia on here. In the past, it was sporting events going to Russia, but further evidence this week of sport distancing itself from Russia. In this case, one former great ally of Russian sport, Thomas Bach, the IOC president, now really on the attack against Russia and their actions. Multiple prongs this week relating to the Paris Olympics in terms of prohibiting Russian and Belarusian athletes who will only be there as neutrals from the athlete parade in the opening ceremony. But a couple of other things from this, which is Thomas Bach really calling out Russia for staging its own sporting events, the Friendship Games, which they see as hugely politicizing sport. And at the same time, Thomas Bach apparently the target of a hoax call from Russians pretending to be the African Union Commission. So really a strident tone by Thomas Bach against the Russians this week. And of course, unlike FIFA, he did hold a very lengthy media Zoom call after their executive board meeting.
Rob, the last part of that, the disinformation campaign that the IOC has pinned on Russia is one that is quite fascinating. We talked about this in the past. They'd issued a press release. And when we looked into it, there was a fake Netflix documentary that was fronted by an AI version of Tom Cruise, and also a fake news report that seemed to suggest that right at the start of the Israel-Hamas conflict, that Palestinian and Israeli athletes will be barred as well, and now this. But it makes this we're still waiting for. Thomas Bach obviously got on the phone with this person pretending to be the chair of the African Union Commission. And now the Russians have recordings of that, if it is the Russians, as they say. And we're probably wondering when that's going to drop. What did Thomas Bach say on that call?
I know, that's that's going to be fascinating. Thomas Bach has had a sort of...
And they got ahead of it by announcing it themselves, didn't they?
Well, I'm sure that was the aim. Thomas Bach has had a sort of sea change of his sort of positioning in relation to Russia. Throughout the Russian doping scandal, he was sort of reluctant to be sort of dragged into any sort of direct criticism. But maybe it's a hoax call. Maybe it's a fact that he doesn't like any sort of challenge the Olympics. So this sort of Friendship Games is a sort of, he sees that as a challenge, and that it's sort of sparked him into some sort of, you know, action which we've never seen before.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? As you say, a sea change. I mean, that targets right at the heart of what the Olympics is. It challenges the games themselves. And he had, people would argue that in the past he had been a little bit too permissive, allowing Russia to misbehave again and thinking they can get away with whatever they wanted.
And the prize fund reported to be around $50 million compared to the Olympics, which has no prize money. And this been in the week that Vladimir Putin was re-elected as Russian president with 87% of the vote. Some statute changes there, something we do talk about in sport often. The IOC warning that athletes are being forced by their governments into participating, thereby being exploited as part of a political propaganda campaign to make their purely political motivation even more obvious. They are deliberately circumventing the sports organisations in their target countries.
Vladimir Putin must be a bit disappointed with that outcome, because I think Saddam Hussein, did he not want to get 100% of the vote? So he's got a bit of a way to go.
He's going to have to ramp up the campaigning for his like 19th election or whichever one he's going for next. Rob, that statement you read had a lot of alliteration in it, a lot of confusing, a lot of P's there, politicization and profit and all sorts of other things.
Propaganda.
So word to those writing these, for those reading them out, it can be a bit of a tongue twister.
Yeah, it can be. And also obviously focusing on the sporting issues, the IOC talking about the complete disrespect for the global anti-doping standard, how Russia corrupted sport all these years, and railing against the politicization of sport. But, you know, I did sort of go back and look at the history of things. So 2018, so at this point, we'd had Russia annexing Crimea. They're in the Donbass as well. We'd had the poisoning of the Skripal, the former Russian spy in Salisbury in England, shooting down the airliner over Ukraine as well. So a lot of concerns about Russia. And of course, all the doping was pretty much well known at this point because we've had all the, you know, the wider investigations. Yet still in 2018, you had cordial, close relations between Thomas Bach and Vladimir Putin.
Which speaks, I think, to Ziggs's point earlier, that this event itself, it targets the heart of what Thomas Bach runs, which is an Olympic game. So maybe that has focused the games more than, you know, annexing Crimea and downing an airline as far as the IOC is concerned. And that does make you wonder where priorities are.
Yeah, this was ahead of the World Cup final that the IOC set after a Bach-Putin meeting. They both agreed that in the interest of Russian athletes, now was the time to re-enter into a dialogue, to look to the future and to bring Russian sport fully back into the international community. And certainly praising changes in Russian anti-doping. Then we had the cover-up of the cover-up, as well as then the full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Ukraine thing has been a huge issue for sport, as well as obviously everybody in Ukraine itself. The IOC has come under a bit of fire. Transgender framework. So its policy at the moment states that transgender women can take part in female competition if they have reduced testosterone down to 5 mmol/L. And there should be no assumption of physical advantage. Now, a group of 26 academics, a couple of them we've had on this podcast before, Ross Tucker, Emma Hilton, and the sort of lead author, Tommy Lundberg from Sweden, they have put out a paper basically calling on the IOC to change this policy and to make it so that transgender women cannot take part in female competition at all. And also to have more input from female voices. So it's, I think it's quite a big moment in this whole debate.
Is this a scientific report, or is it a report by academics having talked to female athletes, women's advocates, women's rights advocates, or is it science, or is it a bit of both? What are we looking at here?
I think it's mainly science-focused. So, for example, Tommy Lundberg has done studies on the sort of long-term effect of testosterone and people going through puberty, and even if they have reduced testosterone afterwards and they've transitioned, do those physical advantages remain? And his research has shown that they do remain. And there've been other similar things. So I think the idea about this paper is that they're trying to take a scientific approach to this, and they're actually saying the IAC hasn't been looking at the science. And so it's not a political thing, you know, speaking to activists or like Sharon Davis, he's been pushing very strongly. I think they're trying to take a sort of fairly dispassionate view of this.
Have they replied then to these academics, or are we still waiting for the IAC?
No, we're still waiting. The IAC are not enforcing their guidelines in sport. They're leaving it up to sports to have their own policies, but they have got a sort of framework. And for example, the USA Boxing have, they on their transgender policy, they're sort of citing the IAC policy as saying we're going to follow this until we hear different. So it may not be, telling the sports what to do, but it's certainly providing some sports with a basis for developing their own policies.
Funny you should mention boxing. I remember talking to the head of one of the medical heads of AIBA at the time, before the Tokyo Olympics, and without the science being proven, he talked about the dangers of this. If there is that residual effect of puberty on a sport like boxing, which relies on power and essentially punching people, the questions about risks have to be asked, he said at the time. I wonder if those have been answered.
And in football, still waiting to see when FIFA will complete its review of the transgender eligibility rules. They have been ongoing for at least more than a year, because we asked at IFAB a year ago. It came up again at IFAB this year as well. And that review is still ongoing. Football doesn't have a complete ban on transgender women playing in women's football, as we've seen athletics and international cricket, for example, impose their own restrictions. Instead, they do keep this policy of assessing within blood testosterone levels. And it's something, obviously, there's been a focus on, particularly in England. So this week, it was something I was able to ask the Cultural Secretary about, Lucy Fraser. Her department oversees sports policy. And the reason it came up is because we're at the launch of the football regulator, something that we've mentioned in the past is coming into English football, being brought through by legislation. And I was asking about almost the limited powers of the regulator, almost the expectation from fans and people in the football, what it might do more than it expects. So people might well ask the regulator to say, well, can you look at, this issue in terms of transgender eligibility? Because there are, two sides of this. There are trans players who want to be able to be included in women's football. On the other side of the debate, you've got people saying there are sort of safety and fairness issues. So it could well be one of those things that is put to the regulator to say, could you get involved? But it's not something that is in the power of, the regulator. Lucy Fraser actually saying she's effectively saying the FA should consider completely banning transgender women from women's football, saying, there is inherent unfairness that if you're not biologically a woman, you have a competitive advantage.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this government has been pushing all the sports to do, and they've had sort of roundtables about it.
One minute we're talking about science and real scientists trying to come up with a plan, and then you kind of politicians politicking. This is somewhere they really shouldn't be stepping in.
Yeah, I did also ask her, would the regulator intervene on things like racist and misogynistic tweets from a particular former footballer? Because, we've not had action. Is that something they might, people expect the regulator to sort of have a view on, effectively? So I was asking what should be done about that, and not something she would get involved with. So a lot of the conversation was about the powers of the regulator. I was particularly delving into how can it really get to the bottom of unscrupulous owners, the investigatory powers. How can it find all the web of companies and issues around certain potential investors? So, perhaps an expectation it can do more than it might have the power to do.
Yeah, and the fact that the Premier League, talk about Premier League clubs, in terms of the wherewithal, they have invested a lot of money in their diligence companies to do these checks. And then, you know, the fact they let them in is another question. Just how far will it go and what the red lines are? Because don't forget, you know, it took sanctions from the British government to send Roman Abramovich home. But for 20 years, he built a very successful winning football club at Chelsea. While, you know, this well-known link to Vladimir Putin was clear and present, and nothing happened. Would anything affect someone like Roman Abramovich back in 2003 or 2005, whenever he came? I think it was 2003, buying Chelsea.
Seemingly not at all. And, you know, talking about foreign ownership, it was Lucy Fraser's culture department that in recent weeks, we discussed on last week's pod, decided that there should not be foreign state ownership of newspapers and news magazines in the UK, effectively stopping the takeover of the Daily Telegraph newspapers involving Sheikh Mansour, vice president of the UAE, of course, Manchester City owner. Manchester City insists it is a private investment, not a state investment. But certainly it was something that I asked about. Well, you know, since you're banning foreign state ownership of newspapers, you know, what about football clubs? Because, of course, some people do see them as being able to be used as political tools as well, like perhaps a newspaper might be for influence.
What does she say?
Well, so this government will not be banning foreign state ownership of football clubs.
Yeah, she basically said it was different. The regulator, I think we've talked before, I think it's people are going to be slightly disappointed in what it does and its range of powers. I think there is one key thing it might do. It wouldn't have stopped someone like Roman Abramovich from taking over. But what it will have greater powers to like access information from like the National Crime Agency, the tax investigators. So they will have more ability to get information on prospective owners and directors.
Guys, for me, biggest story of the week. We talked about Shay Otani a few weeks ago, who got this enormous $700 million 10-year contract with the LA Dodgers. Japanese baseball player who could throw as well as he can hit. He's been in the news, Martin.
His longtime interpreter, Ippei Mizuhara, has been sacked by the LA Dodgers because alleged theft. So basically what's happened is at least $4.5 million has been transferred from Otani's bank account to a betting company. Otani has not been accused of wrongdoing, but it's sort of some questions about why it's come directly from his bank account. And, you know, is this a sort of ruse to cover up some sort of gambling himself? Because that would be, again, potentially against the baseball rules. So it's, a incredible story.
What made it really odd here was the fact that the spokesman who was cleared to talk to the press about this when it came out by Otani's team said it was Otani helped him to clear some gambling debts and then quick reverse ferret once that was done when Otani's team then issued a statement through their lawyer saying they're taking legal action of contacting the authorities over this massive theft. And it is massive. We're talking about $4.5 million in betting costs. God, he must not be very good at that.
One of the dominating stories in England this week: what colour exactly is the flag on the New England shirt from Nike? And thanks to one of our listeners for correcting me on pronunciation last week, Gab.
They're sort of, instead of the traditional red cross for the cross of St George, they've done a sort of multicolour one on the sort of collar of the new strip. I think people should be more up in arms about the cost of it. £125. And not much cheaper for a children's one. So forget the fact that they've sort of had a sort of playful play around with the colours on the cross. I mean, God, the cost of it.
Isn't it bloody obvious? As soon as they mess with that cross, there's going to be a segment of people who are going to be absolutely furious as to the redesign of this. For me, I'll be honest with you, I didn't notice it because no. I don't care.
Do you think they did it deliberately?
Well, then now you've just said this cost is the biggest story is the cost, but no one's talking about £124. We're talking about this other thing. And going to the Rob Harris School of Communications, when you say, why don't you divert attention to something else? could this be it? I mean, how big a deal is it? Tell me how big a deal it is. I don't understand this.
Well, and we're not talking about how regularly kits are being produced. Got to say, when it was first released, one of the things I talked about on air was about the, you know, lack of white shorts. And this has been something that the women's players have been campaigning for. Now both the men's and women's kits have blue shorts. This is something that female players campaign for. That was like the good side of change. And, you know, you do wonder if, in terms of this flag, you know, it has helped us to get a bit more coverage and attention, promoted the awareness of the fact there's a new shirt on sale. Well, and then we had the lead of the opposition, Labour's Keir Starmer, getting involved, speaking to the most popular tabloid in the UK, The Sun, demanding change. And, you know, he did talk about the price of kits as well.
Seen as probably some sort of vote winner thing. But, I mean, honestly, Keir Starmer, you can do better than that.
People are angry about everything. This is like a red rag to those people who like to be, you know, annoyed by stuff. It was kind of inevitable, wasn't it?
Who knows what they'll do with the German national team kit? An end of a 70-year link with Adidas for the German national team. Who knows what colours they'll use for the German flag on there?
I think that's a huge story, that, isn't it? I think from a sports marketing, from a business of sport story, Adidas, it's like German football and that company are synonymous, based in Germany. They've been hand in glove. FIFA's longtime partner as well. The idea that Adidas, this massive German sportswear global company, and the German football team won't be together anymore, I think maybe for those of us a certain age, is a real, real, really big deal.
77 years. It really is a massive deal there. Tim Crow, as former sports marketing executive, he posted an interesting thing about it on LinkedIn. He was saying Adidas will now sort of move heaven and earth to retain and acquire as many individual deals with German national team players to get their stripes on the pitch, to get their boots on the pitch, even though it's Nike going to be having the team kit. And he thinks actually there now will be a really big sort of fight between Adidas and Nike for the FIFA deal.
Let battle commence.
Yeah, that FIFA deal was one of the last ones agreed with Blatter. It was this enormous extension, almost like 25 years or so. I can't quite remember exactly, but it did raise eyebrows, the length of that deal. Good news also for clubs in the market and countries in the market to get their new sponsorship rights, given a potential turf war.
Bidding open for the Sport Unlock merch for all those who want the official kit.
We've got an official mug.
Maybe we should give them away as competition prizes in future. If best question, best guest. Gianni, there's a mug waiting for you.
Roll up.
Well, that about rings an end to this week's episode of Sport Unlocked. As ever, thank you for listening. And if you follow us on whichever pod platform you listen to us on, hit subscribe, rate, review us. We'll land in your feeds automatically. But for now, thank you for listening. Goodbye.